In almost any country, the armed abduction of a single child from its school would be a huge story, a crime as rare as it is cruel. In Nigeria, in recent years, the armed kidnapping of entire classrooms has become wretchedly commonplace, and recent weeks have seen a further significant uptick of kidnap raids on schools by motorcycle-mounted bandits. Dozens of children and several teachers have been taken, some returned, some not. The tactic of large-scale school abductions was made infamous by Boko Haram, the Islamist militia which has spent much of this century menacing northeast Nigeria. In 2014, Boko Haram generated global headlines with the kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls in Chibok, in Borno State. Many are still missing. It is not clear what, if any, direct role Boko Haram has played in these most recent kidnappings. It is clear that Nigeria has a serious problem. But how does Nigeria solve it? Is this crime or terrorism or both? And is the remedy policing or counterinsurgency? This is The Foreign Desk.
But now they've realized that kidnapping children is more lucrative. That's literally what this is about. Just where does the money come from? It really shows you how desperate Nigerians have become just to make money. The economy, ever since Buhari came into power, it's really gone downhill, and people are taking desperate measures to make ends meet.
In fact, in the Northwest especially now, it's extremely concerning as the groups have multiplied in terms of numbers. They've grown in terms of strength. I mean, the jihadist groups are trying to make inroads, so we could have a more difficult situation in the Northwest. But there doesn't seem to be clearly a sense of urgency about dealing with this.
There is a certain amount of violence that's involved here. It's a form of war, not peacekeeping. But that violence has to be located in a broader political strategy of achieving reconciliation. And unless you have that strategy in place, more violence almost always just makes things worse rather than better.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined first of all from Abuja by the journalist Chika Odua, who has followed the story of Nigeria's school kidnappings since the Boko Haram raid on Chibok. First of all, our way into this program is this spate of attacks on schools there has been in the last few days and weeks, some large, some small, some successful, some not. In the general scheme of things, how common have attacks on schools like this become in Nigeria?
They've become shockingly common, to be honest. It's almost at the point where the Nigerian public is feeling a bit of fatigue, and that's really scary, because these should be front-burning stories, but sometimes you get people not even wanting to even know the details because we've heard this before. So the attack that happened this past Monday was actually the fourth that happened since December. And then last year, there were several attacks. And what we're seeing, of course, is that these attackers are no longer really affiliated with the Boko Haram Islamist movement. It's now just bandits, criminals who are looking for money. And this has become a very, very lucrative business, to be honest. Money is being funneled to rescue these hostages, and that's what's keeping this thing going. I mean, from between June 2011 and March last year, at least $18 million was paid to kidnappers as ransom. So, for example, in Kankara, with 300 schoolboys kidnapped this past December, we learned that some of the parents started to negotiate with the kidnappers. The boys, when they were abducted and taken to the forest of northern Nigeria, that's Katsina State in the northeast. So the kidnapped boys, they started to make contact with their parents, you know, with their cell phones. And so they're talking to their parents and they're saying, bring this amount of money in order for us to be freed. So the parents started trying to find ways to do that, dropping bags off here and there at designated points. So in that case, we did see parents collecting money, fundraising amongst themselves. Also, we're seeing professional negotiators kind of coming to the fore. And this especially we see with Boko Haram-related kidnappings. So that's how we're seeing this. We're seeing this in the form of the parents themselves, who are so desperate, raising money for their children, and also professional negotiators, because this is a huge market, you know, a business that has come forth.
When stories like this get reported beyond Nigeria, obviously the media tends to frame them in the context of Boko Haram, because everybody thinks back to that huge kidnapping of 276 schoolgirls from Chibok in Borno State, many of whom still haven't been found again. But if this is now more just your straight up and down ransom seeking banditry, do we know if there is any overlap between the bandit gangs and Boko Haram? Is there any possibility that these bandit gangs are being used as fundraising proxies, if you will?
You know, again, I think depending on where the kidnapping takes place, those possibilities do exist. For example, the one that happened in December with 300 schoolboys, Boko Haram claimed responsibility. But, you know, I'm of the belief that it was not Boko Haram. And what's happening in that part of Nigeria, there's been a lot of artisanal gold mining. And so some people feel that that industry, which is a very murky industry, extraction of gold, is somehow contributing to the rise in kidnappings in northwestern Nigeria, which is where it happened in December. But Katsina, which is where we saw the last kidnappings in the past few days, is not part of that. So we haven't really seen much Boko Haram activity in Kaduna in the past few years, to be honest. Kaduna has been a hotbed of just bandits. You know, these are guys who literally take up residence in the forest. And for the past 5 years, we've been seeing these kidnappers, first of all, attacking motorists, going from the Abuja-Kaduna Expressway. That's been their operation for the past 4 years. So if you're trying to go up to Kaduna, which is a two-hour journey, a road journey from Abuja, you could get kidnapped. But now they've gone and started targeting children. But it's the same group of people, and they have no Boko Haram affiliation at all, to be honest. So they went from kidnapping motorists, and they would target sometimes the huge lorries of passengers, you know, those huge coach buses that take people back and forth. They could also target taxis that tend to be carrying more well-to-do Nigerians. But now they've realized that kidnapping children is more lucrative. That's literally what this is about. Just where does the money come from? And it really shows you how desperate Nigerians have become just to make money. The economy, ever since Buhari came into power, it's really gone downhill, and people are taking desperate measures to make ends meet.
Obviously, a story like this, you would think, again, looking at it from beyond, would be starting to erode seriously into the authority, credibility, and popularity of the government. Are they making any inroads whatsoever in dealing with this? And if not, does that seem to be affecting what people are thinking of the government? You mentioned earlier that a certain amount of fatigue even had set in with these stories, as if it had just become a routine hazard.
Sure. As far as the official response, I mean, yesterday, the military, you know, chief of staff came out with a statement saying we're ready to attack these bandits and criminals. Well, were you not ready before? You know, so they're not saying anything new, you know, so that's what he said. We're gung ho. We're going to do this. We've heard this before. You know, the fact is, there doesn't seem to be much political will, because there's so many entanglements involved. There are people who are benefiting from this. You know, for you to have criminals going into a community on convoys of motorcycles, these guys are not invisible. Everyone can see them, you know, and no one is saying anything. So there's got to be some collusion everywhere. And of course, Nigerians were really good conspiracy theorists. For me, Kankara was extremely strange. You have 300 boys kidnapped in broad daylight with just a few motorcyclists who just came and kidnapped 300 boys, and then a few days later, they're back again. It just all seems very strange. In the past, there have been cases of police officers working with criminals, you know, for home burglaries, for example. That's been documented. Whether that's happening now, we haven't seen that documentation, but in the mind of Nigerians, that potential is always there. So the military has not really been able to step up in its end and really address this. A governor said that he had been trying to bring in drones to allow the state security to really tackle this. But even bringing in drones for security is such a prolific task as far as trying to get them into Nigeria with customs. So he was even complaining, saying we can't even get the equipment that we need to really survey these forest hideouts. That's part of the problem, you know, just the protocol, the red tape, and too many cooks in the kitchen, and some people are benefiting from this, you know. So that's really what it's about. It just goes back to just the typical story of Nigeria is inefficiency, lack of capacity, and lack of political will.
Chika Odua, thank you for joining us. The motivations of Nigeria's school kidnappers may not matter all that much to the children they seize or their terrified families, but does it make a difference to the police, military and government trying to prevent such attacks? What has been tried and why isn't it working? Here's Nnamdi Obasi, Senior Advisor on Nigeria at International Crisis Group.
First of all, I think a good thing to try to establish would be whether there is any kind of overlap or cooperation between Boko Haram and what we might think of as less ideologically motivated organizations.
Yes, the links are not very clear. There are indications of some relationships between them. Some are transactional relationships in terms of buying arms and exchanging money. There are also tactical relationships in terms of training of personnel in weapons handling, ambush laying, and so on. But beyond that, we don't have any very clear indications of relationships between them. We hear from the ground that the jihadist groups, Boko Haram and ISWAP, have been trying, and SARU as well, have been trying to cultivate some of the armed groups in the northwest and trying to forge an alliance with them. They do certainly have some allies, but in terms of the clear working relationships, we don't see that yet. And the groups in the Northwest, the armed groups in the Northwest, haven't really projected a clear ideological position as the Boko Haram and ISWAP in the Northeast have over the years.
I guess to ask the same or a similar question from the other side, for the Nigerian authorities, for the government, police and military, do the criminal gangs and Boko Haram present the same challenge? Can they both be stopped in the same way?
No, they present different challenges. I mean, Boko Haram and ISWAP, the jihadists, are working towards a theocracy and Islamic State. And therefore, it becomes very difficult to negotiate with them because they have a very absolute position. On the other hand, the criminals in the Northwest are working more for personal and group gains. And it might be possible to persuade them somehow to drop arms. They also are not as, I mean, the groups in the Northwest until recently, when they've been scaling up their arms, they are not as strong as Boko Haram and ISWAP in the Northeast. But of course, this has changed over time. We've seen them graduating from using very crude weapons to AK-47s and then to GPMGs and then to rocket launchers and so on. So there is clearly an evolution in their strength. But the main problem is also that the armed groups in the Northwest are dispersed over a much wider area in terms of landmass, and the groups are a lot more in numbers. So it's difficult, for instance, to negotiate with them because you're negotiating with one group and then all the others are still out in the field. So they present different challenges, both in terms of their strength for combat and in terms of their numbers and ideology and so on. They're quite different phenomenon to deal with.
Well, in terms of the armed groups then, what we might think of as the non-ideological ones, what kind of means have the Nigerian authorities attempted to try and either combat them or persuade them?
Well, the federal government has launched a succession of military operations against them since 2016. Those operations haven't achieved the desired results, but the government insists that it would not negotiate with them and it would not offer them amnesties and so on. It would defeat them, you know, in the field. On the other hand, the state governments in the six states of the Northwest and the most impacted states in the North Central Zone, Niger State, have tried different options. Some states working on peace agreements with them, which do not seem to be yielding the, you know, expected results. Others have been adamant in not negotiating with them and you know, aligning with the federal position to fight them. And others have oscillated between the two, granting them amnesty and trying to reach peace agreements with them, and then realizing that they are not amenable to those measures and resorting back to military operations and so on. There is clearly a disconnect between the federal government and the state governments, and there is a lack of unity between the state governments themselves in dealing with this. So there is not a clear, coherent strategy in which state and federal governments are working in concert. There's also the problem that the federal response is inadequate. The number of security personnel, police and army, are too thin on ground. Their resources, logistics, communications, etc., also very deficient. So at the moment, it's difficult to see how this is going to work out. Short of a significant scaling up of numbers on ground and of equipment, prioritizing this really much higher in the security agenda, we will still be in this for some time.
Among the things that have been attempted on that whole spectrum from, you know, hardline police response to trying to reach some sort of compromise to even offering incentives, even at a local level, has anything been shown to work? Are any even state or local authorities having any success with anything?
Well, they had in Zamfara and Katsina states. But those successes were short-lived. They were able to persuade some of the groups in 2019 to release captives that they were holding, to return some guns. And some of the members of the armed groups actually came out from the forests where they are camped and pledged to the government that they would no longer engage in violent activities. But then, more recently, there has been a relapse. Some of them have gone back to the forests. Others have moved from one state in which they have struck peace with the government to other states where they don't have similar agreements and continued their activities. The gains are rather very slim.
Thinking further down the track, are there concerns whether at a state level or possibly even a national level that if a way isn't found to address the activities of these gangs and or Boko Haram, that in some parts of Nigeria the state could unravel or collapse entirely? Are they that big a menace?
There are those concerns. In fact, in the Northwest especially now, it's extremely concerning as the groups have multiplied in terms of numbers, they've grown in terms of strength, and the jihadist groups are trying to make inroads. So we could have a more difficult situation in the Northwest going down the road than we've had in the past. But there doesn't seem to be clearly a sense of urgency about dealing with this. The president, of course, has issued statements again and again urging the military to go after the armed groups. But then those statements now sound quite hollow, given that they've been made so many times and yet, you know, nothing has been achieved in terms of concretely putting an end to the violence.
That was Nnamdi Obasi at International Crisis Group.
There are, as Nigeria's present troubles demonstrate, few more maddening challenges to the authority of a state than an armed group operating outside the law. I'm joined finally by David Kilcullen. David Kilcullen is a former Australian Army officer who has also served as a counterinsurgency strategist for the US military, including as senior counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus and special advisor for counterinsurgency to US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. He's the author of several books, most recently The Dragons and the Snakes: How the Rest Learned to Fight the West. David joins us from Canberra. Let's start, I guess, with a general principle. If you or somebody with your knowledge and expertise and background was asked to deal with a menace like Boko Haram and its associated militias, and you were promised the sufficient resources and political will, could you actually do it? Are all problems like this solvable?
So could it be done? Yes. Could I do it? No. And I think the fundamental thing is that I'm not from Nigeria. I'm not from Borno or Yobe or any of the other areas. I'm not from that community. And it isn't so much a matter of expertise and resources. It's a matter, as you mentioned in your question, of political will. And really that can only be supplied by the community itself and the government of the country concerned.
So is every counterinsurgency so completely different that any comparisons are unhelpful and any lessons are unhelpful? Or are there, you know, are there lessons from Afghanistan or Iraq, both of which you have direct experience, which could be useful somewhere like West Africa, though I know obviously the geography, culture and climate are different?
Yeah, what I like to say to people that my team works with is that principles translate very much from one conflict to another, but techniques almost never do. So principles like you need to separate the insurgent from the population, you need to create a pathway to reconciliation for insurgents that want to reconcile, you need to make the people feel safe, certainly safe enough to turn against the insurgency if they want to, you have to give them a reason to do that. Those principles very much exist in, you know, I've done seven of these and they're very much the case in each environment. But how you do that and the specific techniques or tactics that you might use will almost always be very different and very specific to the country involved, which again gets back to local leadership being essential.
So what are the general principles which do apply in that key task of separating an insurgency from the local population?
So an insurgency is a term that we use for a movement that includes subversion, sabotage, political organization, often terrorism, in combination with military and government or governance activities. And what it is trying to do is to manipulate and mobilize a population to organize them in a way that excludes a government from that territory. And in many cases, they're trying to build a parallel or a competing governance structure in its place. And of course, you can't solve that problem by attacking the population. That's a great way to lose. What you have to do is to, again, realize that the population tends to be static, but the insurgent tends to move around. That's their great strength. They can always hit and run and move away. And a lot of the technique of counterinsurgency is about turning that advantage around and instead living with and working with the population, excluding the guerrillas or the insurgents from being there, building confidence with the community to the point where they work with you to exclude the guerrillas from the community. And then that puts the guerrillas on the horns of a dilemma. They have to either attack you and therefore attack their own natural support base in order to get back in the game, or they have to accept being excluded. And almost always they come back and attack, at which point things get violent. But now the population is of the understanding that the adversary is the guerrilla. Now that's super easy to say in 20 seconds, but 20 years is a short period of time to actually make it work. And it's really about building legitimacy and a relationship of trust between the population and the government. And that's almost never present in an environment where you have a guerrilla group, because if it was, you wouldn't have the insurgency.
What have you learned, though, about how you go about beginning to establish that trust? I mean, I know, as you've just said, it can be an extremely long process, but at some point you need to decide from an initial basis who are the local people who we can work with, who are most likely to help us out and, I guess, least likely to cause us any trouble. Who should you go looking for right at the beginning?
Well, I think there are always groups within a community that are pro-government. There's almost always a much larger group that is pro-government but too frightened to act on that preference. Then there's a large group of people that are impartial or apathetic and can be swayed in either direction. And then you tend to have a relatively small core of adversaries who just are not reconcilable under any circumstances. And the first thing you need to do is essentially figure out which settlements, which towns, which segments of the population fall into which category. And you essentially need to be protecting and working with the people that are already on your side. You need to be making the people that are too scared to back you feel safe enough to do that. You need to be acting to win over the middle ground, and you need to be sort of isolating and containing the people on the other side. And, you know, counterinsurgency is not peacekeeping. There's almost always a certain amount of violence involved on both sides, and some people just need to be killed or captured before they'll stop fighting. But I found in places like Iraq and Afghanistan that that small hard core of people that you just, you know, have no option but to fight and kill is almost always much smaller than we think it's going to be. You know, 2%, 3% of the armed force that you're fighting, not everybody. And I think, therefore, it comes down to, you know, building relationships with people, building alliances, generating the information you need to be precise in who you try to win over and who you try to target. And really the worst thing you can do is to sort of stomp around with a gigantic sledgehammer, cracking heads, frightening and alienating lots of people and arguably doing very little damage to the enemy. And that, unfortunately, is what a lot of countries do in the early stage of this kind of insurgency, because they feel like they need to kind of show the flag and frighten the insurgent. And what they almost always end up doing is making it worse.
There's a line from your own set of principles about counterinsurgency, the 28 articles you wrote, I think, around 2006 or so, that reminds people doing this that you have more combat power than you can or should use in most situations. But even if you don't use the big hammer, how important is the fact of you having it? Do you need to actually carry some cosmetic appearance of having an enormous military force that you could deploy if you wanted to?
It is very important to have that military superiority and to show restraint in its use, but to be clear that you have the power, that you are able to exercise a lot more kinetic weight, if you like, than you're choosing to use. But I think in most circumstances, the reason that you are fighting a guerrilla group is precisely because everybody knows that you've got more combat power, right? I mean, that's why an adversary adopts insurgent technique rather than a conventional military technique. Like, for example, in the Yugoslavian civil wars, people adopted conventional methods. In a place like Borno or Yobe or northeastern Nigeria, the government has overwhelming military superiority, or had at the beginning of the campaign. And that's exactly why there's a guerrilla campaign going on. I think that the most important thing in thinking about the role of military force in this type of environment is thinking of the military as a delivery system that allows the police and the civil government to safely work with the population. So you're really trying to create access to the population for civilian governance and for their own local community leaders and others to engage in a process of reconciliation and building local governance. And if you can do that effectively, there will be some military force involved, but it's often some distance from population centers, and it's really about keeping the insurgency off people's backs while they get on with the decisive business of trying to reconcile.
I want to finish by asking about what we might have learned, especially from the counterinsurgencies you've worked on, about basically how you avoid getting sucked into cycles of behavior that end up actually making things worse in many respects. I'm reminded of the time that I think about 2003, 2004, I interviewed Sadi Yassef, the former commander of the Front Liberation National in Algeria, who later immortalized his own struggle in the Battle of Algiers. When he talked about what happens when you kill a terrorist, the line that stuck in my head was that he told me with a slight smile, you kill one, you create 10. How do you avoid falling into that trap?
Well, one of the things you need to do is not think in terms of terrorist leaders or what we sometimes call high value targets as if killing them is equivalent to defeating the insurgency. It's usually not. And there are many examples, but I think we've previously talked about this. We repeatedly killed the leaders of the Pakistani Taliban over about a 10-year period. A new person would rise up and we'd kill them, and a new, better, more capable leader would replace them and we'd do it again. And over a period of time, we effectively bred a better class of terrorists by targeting the leadership in the way that we were doing. I think that it's really important to be able to target leaders, but you may not be targeting them with kinetic force. You might be targeting them with a negotiating approach based on showing them that their attempt to overthrow the government is useless, but there's a way to get what they want through a negotiated outcome, for example, just to choose one approach. So I'm not opposed to killing people, right? You know, counterinsurgency is a form of warfare. The Boko Haram militants have displaced 2.3 million people at this point. They've killed many, many thousands and kidnapped thousands of people. You know, there is a certain amount of violence that's involved here. It's a form of war, not peacekeeping. But that violence has to be located in a broader political strategy of achieving reconciliation. And unless you have that strategy in place, more violence almost always just makes things worse rather than better.
David Kilcullen, thank you very much for joining us here on The Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolene Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.